The imagination is the connection to the sacred, to the divine, who Ram Dass called the guru, who any of you might call, I don't know, the beloved or the mystery or the presence.
Hello and welcome to Emerging Form. It's a podcast on creative process. I'm Rosemary Wattala-Tromer.
And I'm Christy Ashwanden. Hey, Rosemary.
Hey, Christy. I am so excited about our guest today, Mirabai Starr, because she's been a big influence on my life.
Tell me more about that. I know you've been so excited to get her on, and you really got my attention just by the way you were describing her work as being so life-changing for you. Tell me more about that.
Yeah. Well, I'll say this, that I was introduced to her by another guest on our podcast, Allison Luderman, who we've had on several times. And after Finn died, Allison suggested that I contact Mirabai. And I was like, I don't know. You know, I don't know her. Why would I talk to somebody I don't know? Well, Mirabai has also lost a daughter when the daughter was a teen, and wrote a book called Caravan of No Despair. And so that was my introduction to her, was reading that book. It was so helpful for me to read her experience and what she had gone through and the way that she talked about it in a way that no other books were, actually. Let's just say that there's probably a lot of great books about grief out there, and I didn't need any of them except this one and another by Frances Weller. And so fabulously about Mirabai, I did contact her, and she did not know me, and she did sit with me and really received me while I was in that state of deep, profound grief. And what stands out to me about that time was just how present she was with me. And she gave me this practice. By gave me, I mean, I observed her doing it and thought, that's amazing how seen I feel and how heard I feel. She just said, tell me your son's name. And then she repeated it, all three of his names, and lit a candle.
Oh, wow.
Saying his name into it as she lit it. And then she said, I'll let it burn all day. And I watched her put it, you know, this little votive into a amethyst, a shell of an amethyst, and set it on a shelf. And I thought, really, Mirabai Starr is going to burn a candle for my son all day? Somehow it stunned me with its simplicity. And by the way, that's really at the heart of her book that we're going to be discussing, Ordinary Mysticism, is how do we create small rituals in the moment that help us to feel connected to each other, to the sacred. I mean, that's really what she did. She created a very small ritual. Let me say a name into a flame and let a candle burn all day. In that moment, I felt so heard, so seen, and it was an essential gift to me.
Well, and one thing that occurs to me about that interaction that you had, this is just something I've noticed, is that when you're in that sort of space, you need to be heard and to be seen. But so often what people do is they try to comfort, or they try to fix, or they try to give advice. And she did none of that, right? She just listened. She honored your pain, and she gave it space. And I think so often that's really what we need in those moments.
Yeah. And created a ritual. You know, I mean, I think here we are talking about creative process, and what a sweet, simple, creative act. Let me say a name and light a candle. How simple it can be, which is really at the heart of her new book. And so I'm excited to talk to her about it, because it's a very empowering book about creative practice and how it twines with spiritual practice.
All right, so let's bring her on. But first, I think you should read her bio.
Mirabai Starr is an award-winning author, internationally acclaimed speaker and a leading teacher of inner spiritual dialogue. In 2020, she was honored on Watkins' list of the 100 most spiritually influential living people. And drawing from 20 years of teaching philosophy and world religions at the University of New Mexico Taos, Star now travels the world, sharing her wisdom on contemplative living, writing as a spiritual practice, and the transformational power of grief and loss. And she's authored over a dozen books, including Wild Mercy, Caravan of No Despair, which I just mentioned, God of Love, and her most recent, Ordinary Mysticism. Let's bring her on. Hello, Mirabai. Welcome to Emerging Form.
Thank you, Rosemary. What an honor to be on this beautiful, I don't want to say program, this in this sacred space with you.
Oh, we're so happy to have you.
And I just finished reading your new book, which is just about to come out. I loved it so much. But for people who are not yet familiar with your new book, will you give us a little brief overview of Ordinary Mysticism, Your Life is Sacred Ground?
I'm just getting more and more, wary of codified belief systems that tell you how to connect with the great mystery, meaning religions. And I'm a religious studies scholar, and I've studied the mystics, and not just studied, but really deeply practiced across multiple spiritual traditions for most of my life. You know, a deep lover of the wisdom ways, of the mystical teachings of all traditions. And yet the languaging and the ways that we're expected to frame our intimate relationship with the divine are starting to bug me. And so, you know, the thing about being a writer, and you know this more than anyone, Rosemary, is that your readers get to track what's actually going on with you in your life, in your inner life and your outer life, because they're combined. And so this book is just the latest iteration of my soul's unfolding, which is away from specific ways of relating to the sacred and more embodied and ordinary and everyday. So Ordinary Mysticism is about reclaiming your everyday life as the place where you meet that great mystery.
Yeah, it really comes across too in this book. I said just before we got on together that one thing I loved about it is that it's both an ecstatic book and it's so deeply grounded. And I love that about it. So you wrote in the book, all of my books are someone else's idea. I need to be invited. And I laughed about that. And reading Ordinary Mysticism, I have a pretty good idea who it was that invited you to do it. But would you talk a little bit, I guess, and this is a two-part question. One is, what do you mean I need to be invited? Like, what's inside that? And then maybe we could talk specifically about what the invitation for this book looked like.
Right. So my first book was a translation of Dark Night of the Soul by the 16th century Spanish mystic San Juan de la Cruz, St. John of the Cross. Classic teaching on the transformational power of unknowing, of radical not knowing. And that just sort of fell into place. I don't really need to give you the origin story, but it just kind of came to me. This was in 1999. And then every other book unfolded from that book. It was invitations from publishers first to do different translations of the Spanish mystics, John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila. And then that led to kind of writing about the mystics in my own voice. And then finally to really writing my own story and my own, my own window into the wilderness of the soul, let's say. And often very grounded, because I am sort of a grounded, ordinary person in my regular life. So that's kind of the trajectory, but each one was an invitation from a publisher based on the body of work that had come out of that first book. So that's how that went. And that suits me really well as a person, as an artist. I'm not an extrovert. I'm not a performer, although I do fine on stage. But I am one of those personalities. I know many of you listening are like this too, where you have a lot to share, but you're not going to impose it on people. There needs to be a sense that what you have to offer is welcome, is needed, is in some ways being beckoned. And so that is true for me.
That's really interesting. And I love what you say about wanting sort of a receptive audience. I mean, that's really so important for how a piece lands, right? And whether someone is open to it is so important in these situations. So given that, who is this book for?
Well, I tried on in my mind various potential audiences, individuals or kinds of people as I was writing. And I finally landed on a kind of blend of two people who are both related to me. My sister, Amy, and my granddaughter, Bree. So Amy is my younger sister, who's never been particularly interested in spiritual topics, but is a deeply soulful person, you know, just naturally. And she's interested in esoteric things like tarot and reading cards and things like that, but not so much that sort of non-dual ecstatic mystical path that I've been on all these years. It nothing to do with God necessarily, just more kind of self-actualization, let's say. Bree, my granddaughter, is kind of she lives in Western Washington. She works at a truck stop. She, you know, considers herself to be just a really straight ahead, no bullshit kind of person. And so she isn't the slightest bit interested in anything her grandma's been into all these years. So I thought she'd be a great audience. Like, if I could reach Bree and if I could somehow engage Amy in a meaningful way, that would be who I wanted to write this book for. I've written a lot of books about the mystics, and I have an audience of people who are also really into mystical teachings, who I know are my people, and I want them to come along for this ride, but I knew it was time to be more plain spoken. Like, Rosemary, when you say there was an ecstatic voice, I can't help it. I too am a poet. And so the beauty of language and the power of language is as important to me as any body of information I might be trying to convey. But I also wanted my language to be more plain spoken and more accessible. And so I'm hoping that in this book, I have done so.
Yeah, I think it not only was it plain spoken and ecstatic both. I mean, it is. You are a beautiful writer. It is poetic. But it also felt, honestly, like there were times it felt like a love letter. So hearing that it was for your sister and your granddaughter, I think, helps with that sense of, because it was deeply loving. It was so encouraging. Also, I liked how that felt. Did you know right away that it was going to be written, quite a bit of it, in second person, you know, dear reader, to you? Is that just how it evolved, or did it start that way, or did you change that? Or
what an interesting question. No, I did not have that as a plan, as a methodology, as a writer. But what I did know right from the beginning was that I wanted this book to be about the reader, not about me. I've written a memoir. I've written books, you know, that have illuminated the teachings of the Spanish mystics or Julian of Norwich or others. I've written about the confluence of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam in a very poetic voice. But this one, I knew I wanted to be about you, the reader. Not about my mystical journey, not about St. John of the Cross, but about each of us and our ordinary lives as the domain of the sacred, of where we meet the divine or where we meet truth. And so that's why I think I can't stand, by the way, true confessions, spiritual books in general feel really boring, tedious, and pretentious to me most of the time. And when they say us and our lives are the place where we, you know, it just somehow it feels too preachy, didactic. And so there was an intimacy, a friendship, a quality of companioning that I was hoping for in this book. And the only way to elicit or evoke that, I felt, was by literally saying you, using the second person.
Oh, that's interesting. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the role of imagination here in writing this book. How did you use your imagination to make it into what it became?
I write about my friend and lifelong mentor, Ram Dass, in this book. And I told the story, which many people probably are familiar with, where Ram Dass, toward the end of his life, was being interviewed. And the interviewer said, you know, you talk all the time about these conversations with your guru who died in 1975 or whatever it was. And do you actually think you're talking to your guru? And Ram Dass said, yes, I do. I definitely do every day. I talk to him every day. And then the interviewer said, don't you think that's just your imagination? And Ram Dass said, yes. And he laughed. Yes, yay. And so, and then he expounded on that later, that the imagination is the connection to the sacred, to the divine, who Ram Dass called the guru, who any of you might call, I don't know, the beloved or the mystery or the presence. And so our imagination, he called it your holy imagination. I call it your holy imagination. It's the path, it's the conduit for me for a connection with something much deeper, more alive than I could ever access unless I activate the faculty I've been given of my imagination. So I kind of implied this earlier. I consider myself to be a writer first, that is an artist. I happen to be an artist of words, I hope. And the any content or ideas that I might be conveying have to come through, for me, the apparatus, the mechanism, the basket of language. And therefore of my imagination, because of all the possible words that could be strung together, what am I going to choose? Like, I'm sure you both feel this too at times, and many of you who are listening who are artists of different kinds, there's like this co-creative dance that happens as an artist where you are allowing yourself to be empty, to be available. It's like I see it as I step slightly to one side and let the thing, I call it the thing, come through. But I'm also working and dancing with that thing. It requires my participation. And so that's how imagination works for me with this so-called spiritual writing that I seem to do. I'd really like to be known as a literary writer, but apparently that is not happening. I just can't get out of my box, my cage, my gilded cage. Okay, so I accept. I am a spiritual writer, but it's really important to me that my imagination is engaged in framing and weaving the basket that these teachings come in.
Yeah, that's beautifully said. I love this idea of, you know, stepping to the side, letting the thing come through. I also like that language, the thing. It makes it so not special, not, you know, just what it is. It's just what it is. Not magic, although it's totally magic.
Right.
Of course, it's totally special, but it's just the thing. I want to go back a second. We were talking earlier just a little bit about needing to be invited. And specifically in this book, I believe it was Annie who invited you to do this book. But I'd love to hear the story of how this particular book came into your consciousness as, oh, this is the thing to do.
Well, I was doing a mystic summit online. I was inviting all my mystical friends at the time a few years ago to speak about living a mystical life or the mystics that they might be known for teaching about, like Rumi or others, and so Kabir. And so I brought all these friends together one by one, and one of them was Anne Lamott, who I had met in Maui at a Ram Dass retreat, and I knew from reading her books and from hearing her speak and talking with her in conversation, that she's as much of a mystic as any of the mystics of old, even though she wouldn't necessarily call herself one. So when she came on, she called her talk, because you had to have a title for the summit, Mysticism 101. And she really prepared for her talk, and she had 5 points that she wanted to make. And we had a conversation about each of these 5 points, and it was very ecstatic, and it was really fun and really illuminating. And the thing about Annie Lamott is that she's so grounded and so much about embodied, ordinary, everyday life. And so I found that incredibly inspiring, and also very much in line with, even though I'm known for being a teacher of these great mystical traditions, privately being less and less interested in them over the years. So it was it just coincided perfectly. But at the end of the conversation off camera, she said to me, you know, this is a book. As I was preparing this talk and outlining, and it was just so clear to me, this is a book, but I am not going to write it. I think you need to write it, Mirabai. And if you do, I will help you, meaning I will, you know, support you. And I did, and she did. And, you know, she wasn't like there every step of the way, because writing is such a solitary journey, really, and she knew that and respected that. But her support was there all along, and she's super excited now as the book is coming out into the world. Because it happened, this beautiful vision, this seed that got planted, sprouted and grew, and now it's about to be harvested.
Oh, that's fantastic. What a beautiful origin story, and how generous of her to share with you in that way too, right? You know, sometimes writers can be so competitive and sort of mean to each other. I love the spirit of generosity. That's shown there. That's so wonderful and essential, I think. I think it's really essential. I want to ask you about something you write about in this book, and that is your relationship with Willow, who was someone who became your creative partner. Can you just talk about how that happened and what that partnership looks like?
Yes. You know, one of the things I'm dismantling it here is not just religion, but hierarchy and the notions that we have about who are the teachers and who are the students, who are the mentors and who are the protégés. And Willow came into my life in her 20s. She read everything I wrote, totally got it more than any single human being ever had. And she was leaving the community she was living in, Lama Foundation, and saw that I was advertising for an assistant, applied, and I, you know, immediately recognized that she was just the ideal assistant. She's brilliant. She's creative. She wanted to lift my work in the world, keep me organized, free me up to do the work I really need to do and not have to deal with administrative stuff, which I'm terrible at. And that went great for about two years. And then she was like, why don't we start a company? And we came up with this term Wild Heart, because it really conveyed the essence of what we're about. And just like a place for your teachings. And so you don't have to teach in all these other places. And just really do what we want to make it beautiful, because Willow's an artist. And so she's an artist of the soul, but she's a visual artist. And it somehow combined my language and her art came together to create this online community that we brought together. And then it just became clear within about 5 minutes that she was my partner in this, that she was no longer my assistant. She had quickly outgrown the mentor protege hierarchy, and that together this 20-something, well, she's 30 now, year-old person who had all of these great gifts, and this elder, I'm in my early 60s, together could create something that neither of us could do alone, and that it needed to be an equal partnership. Am I still older? Yes. Chronologically, I am still older. Have I experienced more in the world? Sure. I mean, there might still be some kind of mentorship going on, but it is not overt and it's not the leading energy. The leading energy is that there's this creative fire that has come sparked by our coming together, the coming together of these two people, one of whom happens to be older than the other. And yes, I still feel those sort of motherly protective energy around Willow sometimes, even though, by the way, I am 4'11", and Willow is 6'3".
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So it's kind of ridiculous to even consider myself to be like the nurturing motherly one, but
wow,
I can't help.
That's amazing.
I'm a mother and a grandmother.
I love this though. I love this melding of different perspectives, because that's part of what this is about, right? It's you bring different things to the table here, and you bring different perspectives and different viewpoints of, you know, whatever it is that you're working on, right?
Yes. And also she's, you know, politically very radical and very progressive and very much oriented toward justice and human rights. And so she kicks my ass in that way. She makes, you know, I've always considered myself to be an activist and to be justice oriented, peace and justice oriented. But Willow and her friends and her peers really hold me accountable for those considerations, you know, in a world where there is such suffering and such injustice going on. She holds me to the fire, and I really appreciate that and value that perspective and that passion.
Absolutely. And it's really about, you know, what kind of world is your generation leaving for hers, right?
That's it.
And it's about really talking that through and thinking about what will that be.
Yes, precisely.
It's been wonderful to watch you and Willow as part of the Wild Heart community, and with programs that I've seen with you with the Holy Lament, and which you really do a good job, I think, of not just taking out some of the hierarchy of you and Willow, but I feel like I see you creating an equalizing energy in all the programs that you're doing, you know, like bringing other people's voices in and finding lots of ways for other people to also be the speakers, not just listeners, and to have real conversations. So I just want to honor that I see that happening. So one more question before we need to stop, and that's this. In several places in the book, you nod to creative practice as a way to engage with the sacred. You talk about creating your own cathedral, which, you know, might look like an altar, inventing your own rituals, about using writing and art and music as ways to connect with the divine. So would you just take us out by talking a little bit about the intersection between creative practice and spiritual practice?
Yeah, you know, when I was maybe 15, I was really serious on my spiritual path. You know, I was doing meditation and yoga and working with various spiritual teachers in the Sufi tradition and so on. And the prevailing view was that when you're on the spiritual path, you just do that. You read sacred scriptures and teachings, and you practice the contemplative practices and things. And anything outside of that discipline of the spiritual life is taking you away from the path. And I was an artist, and I was a poet, and I was a singer. And I felt like I was killing my soul to just be on this journey of rigorous spiritual discipline that I was being guided on by various teachers at the time. And it was a huge conflict in me. And it took me years to reclaim my creative life as not other than my spiritual life, but in fact, the very place where my spirit flowered and where I could share it with others. And so that both making art and taking art in, music, write, you know, reading, I'm a voracious reader of literary fiction, you know, and poetry, as you know. All of those things became the very place where my soul woke up and not only rejoiced, but also dove down into the depths that were sometimes painful, but absolutely necessary and beautiful. So does that answer your question?
Oh, yeah, that was exactly it. You know, this idea, I'm thrilled that you said it just this way, too, that it's the creative life and the spiritual life, you know, the creative life is where the spiritual life can blossom and flower, and you know, that they're definitely not separate, you know, that there's this kind of...
Yeah, my spiritual life couldn't go anywhere without the creativity and mm-hmm. arts.
Yeah. Yeah. And you do a beautiful job in the book, I think, inviting other people with questions, with exercises, with encouragement to invite other people on that exploration too.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And listeners, those of you who are paid subscribers will get a special bonus episode next week where we will continue this conversation and find out a little bit more about Mirabai's both spiritual and creative practices. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Emerging Form. This is Rosemary Wetolet-Romer, and my co-host is science writer Christy Ashwanden. Our fabulous audio producer is Cherie Turner, and our music is created and performed by Kira Kopostansky and edited by Leah Shaw. Kate LaRue designed our logo, and Jack Mueller, of course, inspired our work and the name of this podcast. As he always said, you must obey the poem's emerging form. Until next time.
Thanks for listening to Emerging Form. Did you know that for just a few bucks a month, you can become a paid subscriber and get bonus episodes every other week? Go to emergingform.substack.com to sign up. And if you really want to help us out, leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening.